Welcome everybody. The fiddling around here is because all of these talks are recorded. I think most of you know that already. And I think we've also, the fire drill is fairly obvious really. There are several fire exits here and then exits from the building. So I don't think there's any problem with that. So I'd just like to welcome Claire Harris. Claire grew up in this area and now lives in Silverdale. She's an environmental consultant, and as such was employed by Natural England to be our advisor at a key point in the development of the nature reserve. So she's in a very good position this evening to come along and actually put what we are doing into the wider context of how we're promoting the biodiversity of the region. So thank you, Claire.
Okay. I thought I'd first start off by just explaining a bit of my background, really, and how I came to be working with the Fairfield Association. As you said, I actually grew up in Silverdale and went to school at Ripley. So I know this part of Lancaster fairly well. After that, I went to Edinburgh University to study zoology, and then to Reading University to study conservation, a Masters in Conservation. From that, I ended up working for Natural England for 11 years as one of their advisors on the Agri-Environment Scheme. So that's working with farmers to increase conservation. And I did that for 11 years in Wharfdale and Malham and Littondale. And I feel very privileged that I had that patch to work in for so long. My husband then came to Lancaster, got a job in Lancaster. And I followed him, and we have a young family, so I left Natural England and went to look after them. But then in Natural England rang me up and asked if I would come back and do a six-month stint with them to just help them out with a few applications. So that's how I ended up with the working on the Fairfield, and that's why I no longer work for Natural England, and I just wanted to get, I'm no longer in their employment, but as I said, I have worked for them for a long time, so I hope I know what they're about. My aim today was to really discuss the agreement that Fairfield has with Natural England. I want to start off with a brief overview of what Natural England does and to provide an understanding of the Agri-Environment Scheme which Fairfield has, and go into a little bit more detail of that agreement and the management that we agreed for all of the different habitats that are in the nature reserve. And also I want to touch on some of the issues that we came across and how we decided to go about kind of settling some of the people and some of the questions that had come out. So, Natural England is the government's advisor on the natural environment. They have a role to ensure the sustainable stewardship of the land and sea so that people and nature can thrive. They have a responsibility to ensure England's rich natural environment can adapt and survive intact for future generations. They run the Agri-Environment Scheme on behalf of DEFRA. So DEFRA employs Natural England to run the Agri-Environment Schemes. And they don't do any of the payments, they just do all the advisory role. And environmental stewardship is the Agri-Environment Scheme that Fairfield Association has. They also have a role of increasing the opportunities for everyone to enjoy the wonders of the natural world. So they actually look after quite a lot of the long-distance trails in the country, and they're involved in the coastal access route that's going through at the moment. And also they have a role to reduce the decline of biodiversity. So by providing an Agri-Environment Scheme for the Fairfield Association, I think that they have ticked quite a lot of their targets within that. So environmental stewardship, this scheme has actually just finished. It's just had its last applications and agreements agreed. And they're for 10 years they run. And they're just beginning to bring out a new scheme that's being just going through Brussels at the moment. But I'm just going to talk about environmental stewardship. So it's an Agri-Environment Scheme, so it means it provides funding for farmers and other land managements in England to deliver environmental management. The money comes out of Europe and is match funded by the British government. So 50% comes from Europe and then it's match funded by 50% from the British government. There are four strands. Entry level, which is the base level, and this covers things like hedgerow management, basic management of grassland, so preventing too much slurry being applied or artificial nutrients, trying to prevent things like poaching, which is muddying up of the fields around watercourses, and also protection of historic features being under, so reducing plough levels in arable fields, or for example, protecting features of historic importance under grassland. But they're very basic requirements under that scheme, and many of the farmers will have one of those agreements. It was the way that the government moved the subsidies from numbers of animals to a more environmental option, so nearly every farmer has gone into that. And then there's the organic entry-level stewardship, which is basically much the same, but you have to be either converting to organic or be an organic farmer. There's tighter restrictions and therefore more money available under that. A few years ago, about 5 or 6 years ago, the uplands entry level stewardship was added, and this replaced what was called the hill farm allowance, which is where money came from Europe to help farmers in the upland areas, recognising the extra costs that are involved farming in the upland areas. So this basically came in to replace that. And finally, the higher level stewardship. And this is to cover the best land. So this covers land such as SSSIs or important habitats that maybe require some tweaking to improve them, or even in some cases creating new habitats. The higher level stewardship tends to pick out parts of the farm. The entry level is across the whole farm, and then the higher level stewardship will pick out the best bits of that farm, and that kind of sits on top. And there's much, much higher payments within the higher level stewardship scheme, but of course there's a lot more restrictions. So the Fairfield Association's stewardship agreement, when the applications come in, we score them to give an idea of whether it's worthwhile to go ahead with these with each agreement. Fairfield was deemed to be quite important due to its position, really. The fact that it's within an urban population and there's lots of people going to be able to see what's going on there and see the wonders of the natural environment, also the voluntary element of it, was a big plus towards this agreement. Also the fact that its position, it's near to the Fylde coast and also Silverdale and the Lythe Valley and the top of the Morecambe Bay area. So it's seen as a vital bridge between two more rural areas. Also the number of different habitats and the potential to increase the biodiversity in this area. The idea wasn't that it was just going to be left as it is, that there was going to be quite a lot of changes. And also the fact that you had the RSPB supporting you was a big plus. Not just supporting you and saying, yes, this is a good idea, but also supporting you with guidance and help and connections with farmers and things like contractors and things. So what is in the agreement and how it works? So what happened first was that Richard Staughton from the RSPB completed a farm environment plan. And a farm environment plan is an audit of the farm. So he went round all the farm and noted all of the different habitats that were there, the different historic features that were there, the different boundaries and species that are there. And for each one of those, you have to also say what condition that they are in. And that is meant to then guide the person that does the application into which options the land will then be put into. So Richard completed this and then put together an application of which options he felt the land should go into. And that came to me, and I had to then pull together an agreement from that information. When you're pulling together a higher level agreement, you have to look, you agree what we call indicators of success. So you note down all of the things that you want that habitat to achieve. You then have to agree prescriptions with the land managers and any capital works that might be needed, such as new fences, new gates, capital works such as creating wetland and things like that. And at all times, the advisor has got to be mindful of not just that we're doing this for biodiversity, but we've also got to keep an eye on historic features, but also on the landscape, that these things will fit within the landscape. And you have to keep an eye on those two while you're doing it. So within the agreement, we have quite a lot of different habitats, and each one has a different option and a different set of prescriptions. So we have species-rich meadows, an area fen, three fields which are within the wetland for breeding and wintering waders, hedges, arable, an orchard, and the woodland. So this is what the agreement looks like. So if I start from the top green part there is the orchard. Then the big triangle of field, the one along the bottom and the one down that side, are the grassland for waders. There's a meadow up this side here. The blue hatching is the area of fen. This purple here is the arable area. And then we have the small woodland at the end. All those different codes all relate to different management or different capital works, and it was rather a complicated agreement. So then what I want to do really is to now go through a number of those different habitats and go through how they're managed, why they're managed, and what we're hoping will be what will benefit from the management we're putting together. I'm not going to cover orchards and fen, and the reason for that is that they were in the agreement, in the previous agreement, and I didn't negotiate those parts of them, so I didn't feel that it was fair for me to cover those two habitats. So the grassland field, the meadow that we had, was identified as species poor, semi-improved grassland with little botanical diversity and had mostly been managed as pasture in the past. The first thing we do when we come across an area of grassland like that we may want to restore into a meadow is we have a soil test done. This soil test, the main things we want to find out is what the phosphate level is and the pH of the soil. The phosphate level, if it is above 2, we tend to not go ahead with any restoration works. The reason being that a phosphate level over 2 benefits more the grass species, and the wildflowers struggle to outcompete the grasses in those cases. So it tends to be the cutoff level where we'll say we'll restore any that are below that, but above that we'll kind of leave those ones alone because it's not worth the effort really. The pH we look at as well, because that's quite important in the fact that a lot of the wildflowers prefer a more neutral pH, and so we'll look at that and decide whether we want to apply any lime to make them more neutral. We also have a look at what the weed burden in the field will be, so how many docks, thistles, nettles, and also how much cow parsley is present in the field. The reason being that once you start meadow management, it's very difficult to then go in and control those type of weeds because you're putting in wildflowers, you don't want to then be going in with a herbicide and treating them. So we tend to avoid fields that have too many weeds in again. And the other reason is that as part of the restoration works, we try to open up the sward and we disturb the sward quite a lot. So if there's a lot of weeds in there, when we could be increasing the number of weeds that come. And cow parsley is another one, because that's quite an invasive species and very hard to get rid of. So if there's too much cow parsley in there, again, we tend to avoid those type of fields. So first of all, what we do is we put the field into meadow management. So this means that mid to late May, we will take any grazing off the field and we leave it to grow up. We leave it to grow over the summer, letting all the flowers, wildflowers, flower, set seed. And then towards the end of July, beginning of August, the field is cut. The grass is left to dry and turned for at least 3 or 4 days to make sure that all the seeds go back into the field, and then the hay is gathered. We then, once the hay has been taken off, we then introduce, at that point, wildflower seed into the fields. And there's two ways in which we can do this. We can either do it through wildflower seed that's been collected from a species-rich meadow, and they can be collected using this device here. It's basically a brush harvester, and it's a big brush which you see within that drum. It brushes the top of the wildflowers, collects all the seed, and then you just basically have the seed to spread on the field. The other way that it can be done is using green hay. So you cut the hay on the donor site, but you don't let it dry. You put it onto the recipient site and let it dry on there, so the seeds actually come out on the field that you want the wildflowers to be on. It's very tricky, this, in that you have to connect the time of cutting of one field with the time of cutting of the species-rich field. You also have to find a really good species-rich field, and that's where someone like Richard Stoughton, who can connect those two fields. And again, we tend not to do this type of work unless we know there is somebody to help the farmer or the land manager. After that, we then introduce preferably cattle grazing, which will trample in the seeds into the field. Sometimes before we put the seed on, we have to open up the sward, so we will harrow it, and making more open spaces within the field. Usually sometimes when you've just cut the field, it's open enough, but sometimes you have to harrow it and allow more open space to allow the seed to go in. And then the cattle push that into the sward afterwards. And it's important then to try and keep that grass growth over the late summer, to keep it quite short, so that when spring comes, the grass doesn't just get away before the wildflowers have a chance to start growing. Meadows, of course, are a very important habitat, and they're very rare now because most farmers use silage. Make silage rather than hay because it's so weather dependent, and also because they tend to be much later, whereas with a silage field you could get 2 or 3 grass crops off. With a hay meadow you're only going to get one. And also they're important for ground nesting birds because, again, you're cutting later, so the birds have chance to let their young fledge. Whereas in silage fields, when you see all the lapwings laying the nests, then you know that they're not going to survive because the silage will be taken too early. And also they're important for seed-eating birds and also bees, of course. So the two species at the bottom, that's yellow rattle on that side and red clover on this side, those are the two species that we really like to see get into the meadow. The yellow rattle is a parasite of grass, so that tends to keep the amount of grass within the sward down and therefore allow it to be more open, which allows more wildflowers to grow rather than grass. And the red clover is found to produce the right conditions within the soil for better wildflowers to establish. You know, it's easier for wildflowers to establish. So those are the two species that we're very keen to get in right at the beginning. And then after that, once they've got established, then we can look at what species are missed. And sometimes we can actually just put single species in rather than the whole mix. So now I'm going on to the wet grassland sites. So these are the three large fields which are in the centre of the nature reserve. Again, wet grassland is a very rare habitat, even with these wet winters. Intensive grassland management means that most farmers will drain their fields, get rid of any wet areas, and so that's why they're quite rare. They're important foraging sites for wader species, and in Fairfield it's especially the lapwing, which is this bird here with the tuft on his head, and the snipe, which is the one in the left hand corner. But they're also important for the other wader species, such as the curlew at the top and the red shank at the bottom. The management that we agreed on these fields, it's very important to make sure that the grassland is not over or undergrazed. If it's undergrazed, then many of the species, such as the lapwing, and struggle because they like shorter swards. They like to be able to have a good view of where they are. If it's too short and you haven't got these tussocky areas, then you'll species such as the red shank and the curlew and don't particularly like those. So what we tend to do is set the management aiming for the red shank because he seems to be the one that's the least fussy. And if we go for the red shank, then the others seem to like that kind of mosaic of shorter and longer areas. The other major important thing is to actually have some water management and making sure there's wet areas available for them to feed, especially during the winter and into the early summer. The other thing that's important is that the water doesn't stay there all the time in one area. It's not a pond. What we're looking for is that the water spreads out and then retreats, because if it stays as a pond, then the invertebrates tend to die out and the birds have nothing to eat. Whereas if the water retreats back and forth, the invertebrates continue to live, but the ground is soft enough for these birds to feed in. So that's why there was quite a lot. There was a scrape in the top left-hand corner created, and in this area there's a sluice at this end that holds back the water onto this rushy area here. So those areas are very, very shallow, so it gives that ability for the water to come down and then go back up rather than like a pond. It's also very important to prevent the disturbance of the birds during winter and breeding season. So that's why the fence that goes around those fields is very important, because it just allows the birds to just get on with their lives without the odd dog or human walking through the middle of them. In winter it's important because they need to be feeding all the time, and any disturbance will reduce the amount of energy that they have. And in summer, of course, we don't want them disturbed because they should be breeding. One of the big difficulties we have with this type of land is, as I say, maintaining that shorter and longer grass, but without having too many cattle in there during the breeding season, just because of nest trampling. If we had too many cows in there, and especially if you have young cows in there in spring, then you can get a lot of nest trampling. So it's important to kind of have periods where the land is free from cattle or reduce numbers, and so you reduce that risk. But it's also important to have cattle in there, because the amount of dung that they produce also increases the amount of invertebrates that are available for the birds. We don't permit any fertiliser or supplementary feeding in the fields, and that again, it just, both of those things can decrease the amount of vertebrates, the invertebrates that are in the soil, and then the birds have less to feed on. One of the big issues we had with these fields is this hedge that runs along here and some of the other hedges. One thing that waders particularly don't like is tall trees. And this is because predators can sit in trees and see the chicks and the nests. So if you have an area of tall trees, there is about 20 metres away from those trees where waders will not nest. They won't be that close to tall trees. And because that hedge is particularly was between two of the fields, and this field on this side is quite a narrow field, and then there was another hedge on this end, then they had to, the trees had to be taken down. And I know that was one thing that was of concern to some of the members, because of course trees are important as well, but we have to make a decision what we are managing the land for, and therefore go with the management for that, for what you're managing really. And you have to make some tough choices sometimes. So this is probably the most radical option that we've taken on, and I must admit I have never done an arable option before, so it was quite a steep learning curve, because there's not much arable in Wharfdale. There's not much arable anywhere near grassland really. In this country we tend to have all our arable in one area and all our grassland in another. And the days of a mosaic where you have areas of arable within a grassland area have gone. And the reason mainly is that farmers who keep livestock tend to buy in their feed, and the arable farmers don't keep any livestock of their own. So it tends to have now separated, and we've lost the mosaic that we used to have, where a farmer would produce his own food by growing some arable for his livestock, and he would run it on a rotation and change his field between arable and grassland around the farm. And that's now no longer around, and that's believed to be one of the reasons why quite a lot of the farmland birds, such as the tree sparrow on this side and the grey partridge, have declined. So introducing this into this area was a really radical and brilliant thing to do. So what we went for was the low input spring cereal. So what they do is they sow the cereal at a very low seed rate, and this allows quite a lot of broadleaf plants to come in between the crop. So if you can see in that picture there, there's very little crop and quite a lot of the broadleaved plants within it. And this provides foraging areas for birds such as the grey partridge and corn bunting, and it also provides quite a good habitat for brown hare. And when I went out on Wednesday, was it? Yeah, Wednesday, there was a brown hare just in this corner of this field. There is corn bunting known to be breeding in around Cockerham, so it's hoped that we may be able to pull some more this way. It also provides breeding and foraging sites for other ground nesting birds, and I know that you've had lapwing on here this year, and that they actually reared some young. And also in some places it's good for encouraging rare arable plants. I don't think that's going to really happen here because there isn't any other arable in this area, but maybe we could, you know, some may be introduced at some point. This will then, once the crop's been was ploughed in and then taken, the stubble is left over winter, and it can't be ploughed back in until after the 14th of February, and this provides an important winter food source for seed-eating birds, who will feed on the spilt grain and the seeds from the broad-leaved weeds. It's also important for skylark, but I don't think you've had any skylark at all. Some of the issues that we had on this site was due to the fact that it used to be a silage field prior to this. I was very worried about the amount of weeds that would come up after it was ploughed. And by weeds, I'm meaning like thistles, creeping thistles, docks, and nettles. And so one of the issues we had was how much herbicide needed to be applied, because we want to keep some of the broad-leaved weeds, but I didn't want to see a sea of thistles, because it would just have led to a lot of problems. Once they'd seeded across the whole of the rest of Fairfield's nature reserve, it could have been a problem. So I think we eventually came to a compromise of using just a little bit of herbicide if it became a problem. And one of the other major issues is that in this field there are some lynchets. And we came across a compromise for those as well, which I'll go into in a minute. And again, the other issue we had for this is that hedge, which is on this line here, which is between the arable and that narrow wader field I was talking about. And that's that again, the large fields reduces the use of this field as well for lapwing, because at the other end, other side, is pony wood. So this, the hedge between these two fields was really the one that needed to be cut back down. And it has to be kept down, I think they say, below 2 metres. So this was our way of solving the problem with the lynchets. Lynchets are a form of medieval farming where they would have ploughed the top of the strip and put arable within there and kept grassland on the side of the lynchets. And these are some lynchets at Malham. And you can see the stepped profile, because I couldn't really get them to show up much on my stay in that field. And you can't really see them, but the lynchets run across this field here, and you can just about see a grassy strip across there. So we decided that we would have a go at reinstating medieval farming in the centre of our arable patch. So we ploughed the top of the lynchets and we left the sides to be grassland. So this meant that we were protecting them, because if we'd just ploughed them, we'd have lost that step profile. The grassland strips have gone into an option called beetle banks. Beetle banks are usually put in massive, big arable farms and in the middle of their fields to provide a protection not only for soil, preventing it from being washed away or blown away, but also to provide a haven for insects and spiders within the centre of really an arable desert. So, but we used it in a slightly different way in this field. But again, it's also going to have biodiversity benefits. The spiders and the beetles and the insects that will be living in those will be going out into the crop, reducing the amount of aphids and other pest species they have. So hopefully reducing the need for any insecticides to be applied to the crop. Because we have to remember, in order to get a farmer to actually do this for you, for the association, he does actually need a crop off there, because he's not going to spend his time ploughing and seeding. He does actually need something off. So, So that's why we permitted that. We hope that these will aid the farmer. But also, not only that, they provide insects and spiders for the birds to eat. So, again, they're good for the biodiversity in that way. On the edge of the arable field, alongside the hedge that runs around the side, we put in an enhanced wild bird seed mix. This has managed to provide a sustained source of food during winter months for, again, mainly tree sparrows and grey partridge. Why these are used is because modern technology on the farms does tend to pick up most of the arable crop, and so there isn't that much grain spilt like there would have been in years gone by. So this just provides the birds with another source of seed through the winter. Within this, apparently, there's triticale, millet, fodder radish and phacelia, but I'm not so sure which one that one is, because it's now seeded.
I think it's mainly for a relation procedure.
Right.
You don't see much of the
right. As I say, I'd never done any of these before, so this is all new for me as well. This will have to be reseeded every year, and it's not allowed to be removed until the 15th of March to give the birds a longer provision of seed. So probably what will need to be happen is it will just be ploughed with the main field after the 15th of March and then put in. They are allowed to use some insecticides on it, but again, I don't think we're going to need that because we haven't got any other arable around. So that I don't think the pest numbers are going to get to those levels where that will be needed. But if it is needed, then it's only done through Natural England permission. Then again, it's controlling thistles and docks and not using it for access and turning. So basically, it's just putting it in and leaving it for the birds. We situated it next to this hedge because that tends to be where the tree sparrows and the grey partridge like to live. We then also put in the arable field just to make life interesting, an enhanced grass margin. And this is, I don't know if you can tell, this is the canal that runs along this edge. And along here is a number of ponds and wet areas. So the grass margin runs between the arable crop and those ponds. It provides nectar for insects and provides seed for birds. But it also protects those watercourses from any nutrients that may run off the arable crop, because the farmer will have to apply some nutrients to the arable crop. And he's permitted, I think it's 100 kilograms of nitrogen. So to prevent that from running off the field and into these wetland areas, then this buffer strip was put in. It was put in the first agreement year, and it should be managed just like a meadow. So it should be cut late on after the 15th of September and then allowed to regrow. And it should regrow from the seeds that have set. Along there, and again it's just a matter of managing the weeds by spot treatment. And the final habitat that I'm going to cover is the restoration and creation of the woodland at the end, so Pony Wood. Basically this isn't an ancient woodland. It's obviously been a planted woodland at some time, and in its previous state wasn't very biodiverse. It didn't have a lot of different habitats within it. It had a number of old trees of all about the same age and very little understory underneath it. So the aim of this option is to try and increase the benefit of this woodland for wildlife. So the area was fenced off to prevent any more stock from getting on there before the arable was done. And this whole area on this side has been planted up with new trees, including canopy trees and scrubby species. So the canopy trees are things like your ash, I remember now, oak, wasn't there in there? And then the other species, the scrubby species, are things like your hazel and your hawthorn, which provide the structure within the woodland. So you have the smaller shrub species down on the bottom creating cover on low down, and then the more canopy trees providing a different habitat. It's a different woodland than what we usually do with Natural England. And there are different species in there than we would normally find in woodlands, and it was agreed that because of where it's situated that we could put some of the more unusual species back in there. So I think there's some, is it sweet chestnut in there? Yeah, the sweet chestnut and a small leaved lime. So we have put some of those species back in, which we normally maybe wouldn't do in a natural woodland, but just taking in consideration where it's situated. And hopefully we'll allow all, there is some bluebells in there, and hopefully we'll get some primroses and other wild woodland flora coming back through now. There was some of the canopy trees did need some surgery done on them, so we've done that to make them safe, but mostly we will try and keep dead wood, providing another habitat for different animals and insects. And also we put some bird boxes, we paid for some bird boxes to go into the woodland. It's not in the most ideal position, stuck at the top of our arable piece, but again, it's recognising that this is a different habitat and it's benefiting different species and different different birds. And I think that the arable field is probably big enough that way, but also you've got the pieces either side to for it to be okay, really, where it is. I hope that gives you some idea of, a basic idea of what the type of management that we've put into place through the scheme. And just covered briefly some of the discussions that we had, but it was quite a difficult agreement to do because each of the habitats is very small and piecemeal. And also the fact that one of the other big issues we had was what to do with the cattle, because we recognised the cattle were very important in the management of the agreement, in the fact that we needed them in the meadows and we needed them in the wetland grassland, but it's moving them around the agreement at the right time of year. And because if this was a farm, a large farm, we probably moved those cattle off onto a different part that wasn't even in the scheme and we didn't need them, and bring them back when we did need them. But of course, with this being the only piece of land we have, and virtually all of it is in the agreement, that proved quite difficult. And I think the fact that, we can put them onto the girls' grammar school field every so often really helped with that, because otherwise we have nowhere else to put them when we don't want them. So that was probably the biggest and the most difficult challenge, was working out where we were going to put the cows. But yeah, I hope that gives you some idea. Okay.
Could I invite questions? Has any questions for Claire?
Yeah.
I wasn't clear what happens to cereals and other crops to grow on the arable field.
The farmer takes the crops.
Yes. What sort of cereal was it?
I think it was wheat, wasn't it? Was it this?
It was a kind of hybrid between wheat and rye, apparently.
Oh, right. That was put on there.
He feeds it to his cattle in the winter.
Yeah. So that's kind of left to the farmer, what crop he puts in there, as long as it's this low seed rate that goes in. Yeah.
Claire, you've clearly been round recently.
Yes.
Yes, sir.
How are we doing?
Well, I was just saying, it looks really... because I was there discussing on a piece of paper about the arable, it was brilliant to see that in, and I was saying how it fits in. It doesn't stand out completely, you know, that doesn't fit in that area. It looked really good, and the seed, especially that, the seed mix along the hedge looked really good. And I took two friends with me, and they were very, very impressed with them. They said, wouldn't it be nice to live here in Lancaster? Yeah. But yeah, it does, it looks really good. And I've been hearing really good things from Richard as well about the birds that have been on there. So.
I think we should tell people about some of the indicators that you mentioned. If we think about the hay meadow, yellow rattle and red clover. We seem to be specialists in yellow rattle.
Yeah.
A really good crop of that, and good a good occurrence of red clover. I think some of us were rather disappointed that there weren't more wildflowers. Richard tells us we must be patient, and over a period of years we will get some really pretty wildflowers rather than a lot of yellow.
I think what we found, because I've done quite a lot of that in the Yorkshire Dales, the meadow restoration. Is you get a lot, when you bring the seed over, you get a lot of yellow rattle and you get a lot of red clover, and the other species don't seem to come across very easily. And I think you only have two. Did you have 1 year's payment for the seed to come across, or 2 years? I can't remember.
We had green hay the first year, I think, and then. Not this year, last year we had 4 kilograms of wildflowers from Cumbria Wildlife Trust.
Yeah.
And I expected the hay meadow to be a picture this year. We just had lots of yellow rattle and some red clover. But no, there were some others.
And I think the other thing is just to keep an eye on which species you're not getting, and maybe go down the route of plug plants. Eventually, yeah. To pick out those species that are missing and put those in, rather than because the other thing with green hay is you have to take it at the right time, and of course some of the wildflowers set their seed a lot earlier, and you won't get those seeds within your mix when you bring it over, and so there are certain species that will be missed, and likewise there'll be those species that haven't actually set seed when the hay crop's taken. So it might be an idea to pick out certain species that you'd like to see in there and just put small plug plants in rather than the seed.
You mentioned pH and the possible necessity of putting lime on. Was that required in this instance?
I'm sorry, I don't know. I know it wasn't applied, was it? So no.
Right, so presumably it wasn't applied.
Do you remember the pH?
No, because that was done within the first agreement.
Okay.
So.
Yes. Well, kind of two questions really. First of all, about the strip of wildflowers that we put in along the edge of the outer field. Because it's been such a good summer and quite a long one, those flowers are still flowering, many of them, and we're worrying about when we should cut them. It's round about now one is meant to do it. Should we be leaving it until they finish flowering, or should we be dropping them all down and carting them off now?
I'd leave them till they finish flowering, because it's not like you're it's not like you're trying to get a crop off there, is it? So you might as well leave it. The reason why we have to kind of, when you've got a meadow, you have to choose in, there's a date, isn't there? There was the 15th, it's the 15th of July. After that date, you can cut it. And that's kind of set on an agricultural reason as well, in the fact that the farmer does actually need to have a crop off that field. And if we left it any later, he wouldn't be able to make it into hay, because it would just get too damp each evening. That it would never dry out. So we have to kind of be a bit more practical for meadows. But I would just leave it, because you're not going to be drying it and trying to make it into hay. So I'd just leave it till everything's finished and then cut it and compost it.
And then, the other question actually related to the wildflower meadow. We recently had somebody down from the Cumbria Wildlife Trust, and one of the things that she said to us was that we should be thinking about what kind of wildflower meadow we wanted to create. And actually, we didn't know that there were different kinds of wildflower meadow. We had two amateurs all of that. And I wondered whether you had any comments about what kind of wildflower meadow we should be trying to create.
Yeah, that is a big difficulty, really, because you have what they call an upland hay meadow, which you find in the Dales, and that has a lot of the wood cranesbill in it. And then you have more of a lowland hay meadow, which has more oxeye daisy and other species like that. Probably where you're situated, that's the one that you're more leaning towards than the upland hay meadow. But that's the difficulty, isn't it? You're starting from... you're creating something that's never been or long gone, so you don't really know what was there in the first place. So really, I'd probably go with a lowland meadow and go along that species line rather than an upland hay meadow, just because of where it's situated. But if you want to put Woods Cranesbill in it, I'd just put it in, because you're creating it, so I'd put as many wildflowers in there as you can.
Yeah, Yeah, well, I think that would have been our general
approach. Yeah.
Just to chuck anything out there. But I suppose one thing that sort of chimes with what you said is that we've had more difficulty, even with the yellow rattle, down at the bottom end of the meadow, which is near the wetter area. So and it was quite damp in there earlier in the spring. So, and that seemed to make a difference to how much came through. So we were wondering whether we needed to be treating two parts of the field in slightly different ways.
I mean, in that sense, you could be putting the wetter wildflowers like ragged robin and marsh marigolds into that end of the meadow, and the drier species towards the other end of the field. And I have done agreements where I've said, especially meadows that aren't devoid of all wildflowers, but they're just missing some of the top ones, then I have said, and especially when we've gone for plug plants, I have specified them to be put into certain places to create what would have been there in the past. So I would put your ragged robins, your marsh marigolds into that end of the field.
How are we doing for reptiles and other animals?
That's one of the things that doesn't really happen within these schemes, to be honest. They're not really registered, even on the farm environment plan. They don't really go into much detail. When he did his audit, he wasn't required to do any pitfall traps or anything like that. It's kind of it's known that such and such species thrives there, but that's all, and they're not required to actually do any invertebrates or anything like that. So it's more looking at bigger mammals, bigger birds, and seeing how well they're doing, and just assuming that means the rest of it's doing.
No. We don't have any targets, I think, for invertebrates or reptiles.
No, I don't think targets as such. I mean, there are plenty of newts around. People are forever complaining about them in Cornwall Road at the bottom because they're turning up in their basement. And there are also quite a lot of eels. We've seen eels in Amazon Pond, and we actually have a device in there that Richard Swarton is installing for us, which makes it easier for the eels to get up and over the bunt that we put in to try and block the outflow of water, to try and make that area wetter. So there are enough eels around there to need a special eel pipe.
It's got like a carpet inside it, hasn't it? Like, well, a rough bit they can climb up, so it allows them to get out.
I was intrigued by it's part of the wild landscape, and I'm particularly thinking the Oxford tendency to look inwards at what's happening within the nature. I'm just interested to think about the context and whether, to what extent, the canal and the hedgerow network down the river actually play any important corridors functions for the rivers. I mean, that's something that you should think about.
Yeah, they're vital for getting speed. The corridors and the connectivity of the hedgerows down to the river or down to is very important, and that's why putting that arable field there is quite important as well, because they're trying through the agri-environment schemes. They've got quite a lot of arable now coming into the Cockram area, so this just extends it just that little bit further up. So that's a good thing. But yeah, that's one thing. As an advisor, when you get these applications in, that's another thing you've got to take into consideration, what you've been doing around it and whether it fits in within that scheme, and also then to try and target farms that we might have missed and target and try and get them in. Is it nice?
I have to apologise for this question.
Oh, going home.
You might want to say, sorry, I don't know anything about this, which is what everybody else has said. Our wet areas seem to be specialising in a plant called water figwort.
Right.
Do you know anything about water figwort? We don't know whether it's a good thing or a bad thing that our boggy areas have been taken over by this plant, And no one else seems to know, so I thought I'd ask, well,
no,
perhaps
sorry.
Claire knows about
it. No, I don't. I'm a, no. Is that within that rushy,
yeah,
wet area in the pond?
It's extraordinary. All our areas, which are predominantly rushes, this year particularly, this plant, which was there before, but as a minority plant, and it just expanded. Perhaps it's just this summer, we'll have to see. But as I say, we don't know whether this is a sign of a healthy environment or it's been taken over and it's what Natural England call an undesirable.
No, I think we would know if it was an undesirable. So it's probably not, you know. It's a bit negative, my job, in the fact that you know all the negative things and not always the positive, so probably it's not that bad a thing. We just have to see.
That was just a chance.
Sorry.
Can I just make a point that sort of follows on from your talk? Richard Staughton will be giving a talk in here at 10:30 the coming Wednesday in the U3A series of indoor birding that I run on conservation projects in the area. And of course, I have no idea what he'll actually talk about, but I'd be very surprised if he doesn't talk about some of the projects in Fairfield. So anyone who wants to come, whether U3A members or not, you're very welcome to attend on Wednesday in this lecture theatre at 10:30, this coming Wednesday.
He's been doing a lot of work down the Fylde area, trying to get farmers to enter into the schemes. So.
This is a comment rather than anything else. What you probably don't know, unless you actually kind of went out into the fields, is that we have done something extra. In the corner of the arable field that's furthest away from humanity, we now have 18 beehives.
Oh, right.
And so some of the wildflower margin that we've put in the area near there was actually butterfly and bee friendly.
Oh, right.
So there's borage as well as seedling and various other things in there. So whether that's a good thing or a bad thing,
that's brilliant. You know, as I say, the schemes aren't really. I think there is an option for invertebrates, but it tends to be more solitary bees and stag beetles and things like that. So, and I do think that it's been neglected, so in the past. So I think that's a good thing.
Well, if there are no more questions, I would like to thank Claire very much. I think that, certainly from my point of view, there's lots of bits and pieces here that I've known or picked up over the last year. But I very much wanted this lecture series to actually give us the opportunity to have a look at the whole thing that we're doing and try to understand the whole of the management of the Fairfield Nature Reserve. Because I think people have not been very clear as to why we've cut hedges or why we've got an arable crop. And I think today has been really, really great, actually, in explaining all that to us. So, Claire, thank you very much for agreeing to come.
It has actually been a real pleasure to do this agreement because it's so different from what I was used to. So.
You've also made us feel very good about ourselves. always a very good thing. So thank you very much for that.